Item 15 is an information item. And one second. This is from the San Lorenzo River Bacteria Evaluation from the Coastal Watershed Council. We have Greg Pepin, who's going to give you the presentation. And the San Lorenzo River Alliance formed a water quality working group in 2013 to address issues related to water quality in the lower San Lorenzo River and its tributaries. The initial focus of the work group's activity has been to address impairment of river water quality by bacteria. The group wishes to improve the general quality and beneficial uses in the lower reaches of the San Lorenzo River and address resolving the impairment as described in the San Lorenzo River Watershed Pathogen Total Maximum Daily Load. The work group to date has employed a dual focus, water quality monitoring and bacteria source identification and prioritization. Greg Pepin from the Watershed Council will present the work of the Alliance has been doing and the results of recent water quality and source identification studies. The Alliance intends to use the source identification results to guide efforts at source reduction and control.
You can sit here at the table, it'll be fine.
Morning to the chairman and members of the board. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present to you, and thank you for the flexibility. I was had a meeting this morning that was challenging to reschedule, and so I was told to come as close as I could to 11. It just goes to show that sometimes government proceedings are faster than you think, so good for you for moving along.
Enjoy it while you can.
Yeah,
and
right.
Also, if you could state your name, please. For the record.
Greg Pepping. I'm the executive director of the Coastal Watershed Council. We're an environmental nonprofit based in Santa Cruz, and I'll be talking about the Coastal Watershed Council as well as our leadership of a coalition of local agencies, neighborhood groups, residents, and other nonprofits called the San Lorenzo River Alliance, focused on that watershed. Just a little bit about the watershed that we're talking about. This is in the northern end of your beautiful region. And so this is a map of the watershed. This is the largest watershed fully contained in Santa Cruz County. The Pajaro is a larger watershed, but that is in and outside of Santa Cruz County. This is another picture of the mouth of the San Lorenzo River. The river is almost 30 miles long, starts up near the summit and near Castle Rock State Park and flows almost 30 miles down to our iconic boardwalk that you see there. And you can see the Santa Cruz, that's downtown Santa Cruz and some surrounding areas that I'll talk a little bit about. Our community has had a varied history with the river. This is from the Venetian Arts Carnival some many decades ago, and it's when our community used to have a really strong connection to the river, including great water quality and lots of fish. The hotels were full of people. I need to make sure this doesn't auto-advance. One second. Thank you. We've had a long history of boom and bust, and the reason I say boom and bust is because in 1769, Spanish settlers came and found Ohlone settlements near the river, and they were temporary settlements because they flooded out, but the Spanish did not know that or didn't heed that, and so they built there and got flooded out and learned the lesson. So for decades, the growth of Santa Cruz was up on highland, and we just grazed sheep and cattle in the lowlands, but eventually with growth, we came down into the floodplain, and we had decades and decades of boom and bust until the big one. And the big one for us was, you might think of Loma Prieta earthquake, but one of the big ones for Santa Cruz was the 1955 flood. And we had 3 to 4 feet of floodwaters moving down downtown Santa Cruz, and I think over 10 people killed and businesses and homes destroyed. So our local leaders did what many of us might have done, and we said never again. So we built our first flood control structure, and every number of years there have been improvements to the flood control structure. This is what it looks like today. The community, the river in the lower part of the river has somewhat of a back alley feel rather than a front yard feel. It has kind of an irrigation ditch feel rather than a great urban park. We are trying to reconnect a healthy watershed to a vibrant community. And how we're doing that is one of the things, as was explained in the intro, is that we're focusing first on water quality. There are a number of TMDLs approved for the river, and we're focused on the pathogen one. If you imagine the community, they care about all these things perhaps, but the yuck factor for many normal residents, usual everyday citizens, is the pathogen of bacteria, and that's what they care about. We're very focused on that for that and other reasons, and these are just some of the steps for your TMDL approval. We put together a working group for the last couple of years. It includes the city and the county, as well as the Coastal Watershed Council, and then some of your staff have participated, and we thank them for that, and Surfrider Foundation. So we have some of the right players. One of the early successes is that we're all guilty, perhaps, of not sharing data and getting more data and then not sharing that data and getting more data. And so we did a really good job of pooling the data and sharing it and doing a deep dive to learn what we could from that. Those lessons then guided us on some additional monitoring that I'll describe to you. You're familiar with the fecal indicator bacteria that are required of city and county agencies under permits. And there are a number of parameters that one can use to satisfy fecal indicator bacteria monitoring. But they have a number of limitations. It's a blunt tool, really. It's an outdated tool and in some ways a misapplied tool. It just doesn't tell us the source organism. They also take a while to develop. So what we did was I'll tell you about some other tests we did in addition to FIB. First thing I want to do is share with you some of our guiding questions. We wanted to know what the level of human bacterial contamination was in the lower San Lorenzo River. And for a number of reasons, we focused on the lower. The San Lorenzo Valley identifies with the river more, they're more connected to it. But there is a larger population in the lower river, and there's also an opportunity to change that riverfront. So that's one of the reasons we're focused on the lower river. There are bacteria from a number of organisms in the river, and it's known by epidemiologists that the human sources are the ones that are most likely to make you and I sick. So that's one of the reasons we focused on that. So we wanted to focus on human and then find out the key sources. Those are the two guiding questions that we had for this working group's effort. And so a little bit about the who, what, where, when. We did this in the dry season. The wet season monitoring data is just so noisy. It's not really instructive to take away any lessons from it. So we focused on dry season. We picked dates from May to October. That's the recreational season. If you imagine the beneficial use, people contact and non-contact recreation. And because it's the lower river, much of what I'll show you on the map is influenced by tide, so we had to factor that in as well. So that's a little bit about the when. This is a description of the sites, and rather than the words, I'll show you here on the map. Here's where the boardwalk is that you saw in that photo. This is really the heart of Santa Cruz downtown right here is Pacific Avenue, Front Street as well. Highway 1 is here and goes over up to Highway 17 here. So yes, sir.
How far on your map does the tidal influence shows?
It stops about here. Our county administrative building is right here on Ocean Street and Water. And water is known, that's about when we stop seeing salinity from tidal.
How about up Branch of 40 Creek there on the right?
Oh, Michael, that's a harder question. I think somewhere in here, if I'm guessing, I'm guessing a little bit because I think it's right in here. I don't think it goes above Market Street, this Market Street Bridge. So the who, what, where, when, how, the how. We picked fecal sterols, and I don't know if have any of you had your cholesterol tested lately?
Yeah.
But you do sometimes, right? And so cholesterol is something that is It's partially specific, meaning it comes from other organisms, but their cholesterol breaks down in the environment and changes to cholestanol, and there's caprosterol and caprostanol, and there's a series of compounds called fecal sterols. And individually, they don't tell you that much, but if you look at the ratios of them, you can tell whether it's an avian source or human. So that's one set of tests we did. We did do the fecal indicator bacteria. That is often done, so that continued. And when I say we, this is the city and the county and the Coastal Watershed Council and some of our volunteers led by staff. We also did human bacteria DNA, so bacterioides, which is quite specific for humans. And then we did caffeine. So I'll show you some results for some of these tests. And the point is that any parameter you pick may have some strengths and weaknesses, and the idea here was to have multiple lines of evidence. And then you have more of a robust storyline that you can bank on. It tells you something that you can rely on a bit more. So the results of the fecal sterols, there are two different indicators for humans. And the first one, this is a little bit challenging to perhaps wrap your head around, but recall that I said six sites and six dates, six by six, so you have 36 samples, a pretty small data set, but this was quite expensive to do. So we have two hits out of 36 that show the presence of human bacteria. The conventional wisdom would be that septic up in the valley is polluting the river, that you have homeless encampments, that you have leaky sewer laterals, and this runs counter to that argument, and it's helpful. Again, what are you going to do about the bacteria? You need to know the source organism, so this is part of fleshing out that story. So two out of 36 say yes to human. And then the next one, another ratio of these fecal sterols, has 36 samples with zero. So two out of 72 said we've got the presence of human bacteria. That's an interesting takeaway. And then you have a ratio, one of the ratios of fecal sterols that is for avian shows 34 out of 36. Now, this one's probably not so much of an aha moment because you can see lots of gulls and a number of other waterfowl in the river. But again, it's interesting to learn that humans not so much and the birds, yes. The other one was caffeine, and I don't know if you're all familiar with this, but it's a pretty reliable test. The city of Santa Cruz is using this in their storm drain system to look for leaks from the sanitary system, and with pretty good reliability. So they do that at the wastewater treatment lab. It has a really low detection limit, and we had 0 out of 36 for this one. So that was, again, birds and cows and raccoons and dogs don't drink tea and coffee like you and I. So this is specific to human, and it's helpful, if not a huge takeaway, but it's, again, one of the multiple lines of evidence. And then for DNA, we did human bacterioides, and this was done at the county lab, as well as some outside labs. And we have three of the 36 samples, again, the six by six, just three suggest human contamination presence. And the TMDL, the pathogen TMDL, actually, you may recall, I know you've got a lot of documents and you don't have command of them, maybe some of you do immediately, but this is pretty similar to a study that was input data for developing the pathogen TMDL for the San Lorenzo River, and these results were consistent with that. And we also we added on that and added some other analytes as well. So our next steps are to do the same thing, because this is a pretty good takeaway, we think. But you have to qualify it by recognizing that this was in 2014 in the middle of a drought. We still won't do wet water sampling or wet season sampling because of the noise and the limited the takeaway lessons there. But we do need to do a dry season after a normal wet season. Perhaps, and hopefully this will be that season, and then in the May to October of 2016 we can repeat this. That'll be really instructive to see what we get out of that, because you do have to kind of qualify this data set. Number one, it's a small data set, and then again, it's a dry season data set. The other thing is we will continue the source identification and prioritization process. We are doing that right now with the partners that I mentioned, and I want to thank the staff, waterboard staff, for participating in some of those discussions. And then the source control. The next one is to consider which steps the basically it's the city and county as the main actors here, and consider which steps they might take. And also as a part of that conversation, consider whether the allocations could be changed. So staff are initially receptive to that, and it's helpful to have a cooperative, collegial conversation about that. We don't know where that's going to go right now, but the idea of it was we found staff receptive to, so that was encouraging. And of course, so the focus is, as the TMDL says, we want to reduce bacteria as much as possible, but we want to absolutely eliminate human sources of bacteria. It has to be zero. And 2 out of 72, for example, is good, but it's still 2. So that's the one we want to do on the next steps. The other thing I wanted to share with you is to talk to you a little bit about other things we're doing beyond the water quality piece, because I think it's just kind of a feel-good story, and you've got some challenging issues, and perhaps it's helpful to know some good news from another part of your region. And some of these players you saw on the water quality working group of the Alliance, but the Alliance is made up of a number of members. It includes the usual suspects you would expect to be at the table in this conversation. The thing that's encouraging is that it has some unusual suspects. We have the Arts Council, for example. We have the Chamber of Commerce. So we're trying to get businesses and other organizations that might not every day talk about the river, but recognize that from a drinking water quality, drinking water supply, from an economic vitality standpoint, from a quality of life, where do I take my kids, in addition to the environment, all of those, the river has an impact on all those parts of our community. And we're trying to expand that conversation and broaden the constituency for people that who care about the river. So we are focusing on water quality, as I mentioned, and we follow state and federal protocols so that it's valid scientific data. We also engage the public. So it's a citizen science effort. We include her and her and people like them. And we include youth. And beyond science, we get kids out just doing fun things, and we kind of sprinkle in science and positively brainwash them. We say they're going to get brainwashed, so why not make it positive, and why not have it be nature awareness? And so we get them along the river doing fun things, including bike rides. And in addition to the youth events, we have community members, adults and youth, out removing invasive species like Cape ivy. And for many people, connecting to the river would mean paddling. I'm not sure if any of you are aware, but this is illegal, actually.
Illegal?
It's illegal. And we have a special, this was a legal activity, but in general, that's illegal.
Why?
In 1982, and then modified in 1985, City of Santa Cruz ordinance declared that recreational access along the lower river in City of Santa Cruz was illegal. What happened was it took a while to develop consensus on the why for that ordinance. Sometimes you get things on the books and they just stay there a while. And I talked to folks that were very involved with city politics decades ago, and it took a while. But this is the storyline that there seems to be consensus around. Right by the boardwalk, the photo I showed you, there's a sandbar that develops seasonally. A woman was walking across that and it breached, and she got swept out to sea and nearly died. She or her family sued the city. The city at the time was self-insured, and financially it would have brought the city to their knees. A judge threw it out, but local leaders decided, I think it expanded their, it wasn't paddling, but I think the incident expanded their imagination to the liability there, and they decided no paddling. So it's illegal to take a kayak, a stand-up paddleboard, or a canoe on this river in the city limits. The Coastal Watershed Council worked with the City of Santa Cruz to have a special permit day to get people out on the water, and we had 50 people. It was pretty cool. It was a love fest. It was a really neat feel-good moment. It's a bigger river than you think. It's an interesting angle to see your hometown or the town you're visiting. It is more natural than you'd think, even though there are bridges going over it. It was awesome. But as we held more and more of these events, we did them monthly, there was more of a pushback from the birding community saying that many boats with that activity was negatively affecting the birding population as they nest and breed and eat. So right now we're in a 2-year, City Council decided in June of this year to do a 2-year study. They just finished a fall birding survey. During the same period next year, they will allow paddling and also do a bird survey, and they will kind of compare that data. They'll also observe paddlers to see if they're following the rules, because there's a how and where and when and how not to behave on the water. So the Coastal Watershed Council, as an environmental organization, we don't want to do something that's bad for fish or fauna, but we also realize that it really does feel like a back alley. And for some people, I mean, changing that is going to take a constituency connected to the river. And for some people, that means paddling. So we're imagining a way forward where you can do that legally and safely. And it's also, I mean, it's a flood control system. So it's not a nature preserve. It's already a human impacted system. So we've taken our lumps for this, and we're trying to navigate the middle road where we can figure something out on this. A couple of other things to share with you. So we had an art, a poetry reading down by the river with over 100 people. So we're hooking people that wouldn't not otherwise be interested in the river. They were amazed at how beautiful the setting was. This is from a June event in Santa Cruz called the Ebb and Flow River Arts Festival. A lot of artists and creative individuals in Santa Cruz, and they just kind of avoid the river. But on this day, they dressed up in blue and whatever river garb you might imagine and walked along the river, and we had hundreds of them. As the people walked along the river, they saw 10 temporary art installations, and this is one of them. It's kind of hard to, I positioned this photo just as the artist was imagining it. These are staked into the river, and they're iron cutouts. They're flat planks, and if you stand here in a certain way, the idea of the artist is you can see what used to be along the river. I think it's called Ghosts from the Past, so that's kind of an interesting art installation. And this is an Ohlone person on the Highway 1, the pedestrian bridge very near Highway 1. This lit up at night. It was really cool. And so there were 10 of these that people could see along the river. It all kicked off with a First Friday art tour. So you can imagine if you've been there. Have any of you been along the lower river recently? Yeah. So Board Member Johnston will know, and others can imagine, if it's not a very safe place, it's probably not a place you want to go to at night. But we had hundreds and hundreds of people walking along the Riverwalk at night on this First Friday kickoff, and this was an aerial dancer rappelling down from the Soquel Avenue Bridge, so that was kind of and then we projected a movie on the base of the bridge, underneath the bridge. It was pretty neat. We also held a fundraising dinner, and maybe you're not that interested in a fundraising dinner, but what was interesting is that we turned this park next to the river, that's not a very inviting place, and brought elected officials and thought leaders and businesses and donors to the river, and gave them a new setting to appreciate the river. Totally changed it, the vibe and feel and look. So it was sort of like a farm-to-table swanky dinner where you could imagine that's what the river, an activated river, could look like. And so we're focusing on the lower San Lorenzo River. With success here, we want to expand it upstream. If this coalition approach works, we want to expand it to other parts of Monterey Bay. This is what our river looks like today. It looks quite fine. I actually really like our bridges. But these are some photos from other rivers. This is what ours looked like today. This was a nice green shot from before the long summer. And I'm just flipping through here to show you some photos of elsewhere. This is Santa Cruz, and this is elsewhere. This is Santa Cruz. I actually really like this photo as well. We have some California poppies there. And this is elsewhere. This is actually a rendition. I'm not sure if this one is built yet. And this is elsewhere. And this is elsewhere. And so what we're doing is asking people to imagine that the boardwalk, West Cliff, the Redwoods, the beaches, the mountains, and those things that you're proud of when you come to Santa Cruz, imagine that the riverfront, a thriving riverfront like you've seen in other communities, we're asking people to imagine that. So I wanted to share that with you as our imagination, and because we have a history that includes a connection to the river, and that's what we're working on. The presentation today is about water quality, but I wanted to share with you the context, the larger context within which we're working, because we need to develop the political will, and we develop, again, a broader and deeper constituency that feels a connection to the San Lorenzo River, and that's what the San Lorenzo River Alliance is working on, and that's what the Coastal Watershed Council is committed to. So thanks again for the opportunity to present to you.
Mr. Johnson? Yeah, just a quick comment and a question. I like the approach of developing a political constituency for a watershed. I've seen that in Watsonville, where the Watsonville slough system, which kind of runs through the heart of Watsonville and used to be not even backyard, more like cross between backyard and trash dump. As they've done development on the margins of it, they've used developer money to not only clean it up, but build a whole network of paths along it. And it, what it means is that tens of thousands, literally tens of thousands of people who live in Watsonville and vote, use those paths, walk along them, and kind of consider it part of their backyard now. And it's given a real political constituency to those wetlands, which are, you know, the lungs of Watsonville. They're also a key part of their stormwater system. And so I get the concept. I like it. When I look at this staff report and where you guys are going on the sources of the bacterial contaminants, the assumption I make is you're moving in the direction of trying to create both the knowledge base and to the extent that remaining human bacterial contributions can be eliminated, the factual base to change that TMDL as a basis to open up the river to recreational use. Is that correct? Is that kind of what you're thinking on this?
I wouldn't say it's tied to the opening up the river to recreational use. The conversation we've had with the city and others in the community, I mean, there was a conversation in the community about paddling included a water quality concern portion, but the water quality work has a broader interest than the paddling thing. Paddling could go away and we'll still do this work because we believe in having a healthy river that people could just splash in. You could take your kids and your grandkids down there.
Okay, I get that. I guess my question is this. We have a whole unit that does TMDLs. We have lots of TMDLs in line. You know, they're very labor intensive. We have a bunch of them in line to be done. And going back and redoing existing ones is another chunk of work, you know, that takes away from other work. So I'm trying to understand the benefit of that, because that it seems to me that, I mean, clearly you guys are raising that as a potential. So what's the explain to me the benefit of that?
Mm-hmm. If I understand your question right, I mean, in simple terms, the city and county are spending money on things that aren't really helping water quality. And that's the city and county's decision. But as a nonprofit and partner at the table, what we're trying to do is foster a dialogue on stuff that's helpful. They're spending money on testing, but the FIB is not that useful. And we have to do it until we don't have to do it anymore. But perhaps some recognition of the limited value of that. And these other tests are more instructive. They'll tell you what to do. And then that can guide the actions that the city and the county are taking. And in fulfilling an implementation of the TMDL, we want that to be part of the conversation. I don't know am I answering your question?
I think so. I have to digest your answer a little bit, but I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I also want to share that I get your point about the staff resource, the heavy lift of another one or a redo, and maybe the implementation. Maybe it's not a redo. Maybe it's just factoring in this unique approach in the implementation of the TMDL.
I just wanted to add something that we talked about with Greg, who represents the Watershed Council, but also representative for city and county that was involved in this study. The implementing mechanism for this TMDL is the compliance with the stormwater discharge permit for the city and county. So their study is going to be focused on helping the city and county identify the highest priority and most effective and appropriately aligned management practices or measures to control human sources of bacteria to the river. We also told them that we didn't think reopening the TMDL at this point was high priority, but we're interested in adding to the science of how some of these other indicators can serve as numeric targets that are better aligned with what the types of bacteria that are causing the actual environmental problems and actually impairing the beneficial uses. And there's other studies going on in other regions in that regard as well. So a whole alternative to dealing with the TMDL is to allow those targets to be alternative indicators of effectiveness of the control practices, which would at least show that those responsible parties are in compliance and are addressing their contribution, and then we'd have better information about the extent to which natural or uncontrollable sources are a problem and how to deal with those then.
The science has evolved. You know, 10 years ago, the Los Angeles Regional Board, in dealing with bacteria issues along their coast, developed a concept called the, help me out, Lisa, I forgot the watershed, the natural...
The natural source exclusions, and their targets are...
The watersheds where they would look at...
Oh, the beach closure days, is that what you're... What do they call it?
Reference watersheds.
Thank you. reference watershed.
What they would do is, so they had storm drains and coming out of the beaches with bacteria loads in them, but, you know, they trying to, as Mr. Pepin described, it's difficult to, even more so back then, describe what is the source. So they would look at the bacteria loads, looking at certain indicators. They would go to watersheds that were very similar but weren't urbanized, and they would look at the bacteria load from that and, in essence, subtract that from what they were seeing in the urban environment, basically giving it credit for what were natural sources. So it's something that the regions have been trying to deal with for, you know, more than a decade now, and we're just getting better at it and more sophisticated, and the tools are getting better.
Mr. Young?
I have a question for Lisa. So does the TMDL or the stormwater permit address what weather flows for bacteria?
You mean distinctly from dry weather flows?
Yeah.
Or I think we discuss seasonality, but the goals and targets are the same all year round.
Of course. So I'm kind of curious. I know you said you're not doing wet weather testing because of noise, background noise, but that is potentially sources of contamination.
It is.
When you've got wet weather, you've just got a much larger piece of the land imprint contributing to what might be coming into a waterway. But that is what is affecting water quality during the wet weather season.
Right, and we have wet weather, ideally, right? So
yeah.
If we have dirty water during wet weather, then we need to care about that time as well.
Right.
We get, yeah, and that's, so I should add that to my qualifier on this. It's a small sample size. It is dry season. It is dry season after, in a drought. And yeah, water quality during the rainy season matters as well. As far as a takeaway, you know, lessons learned and how to instruct our efforts and prioritize the resources we have, we collectively, we started on dry, but okay. I get your point about you gotta care about the water quality in the wet season as well.
Of course, because look at the number of months that you're not
right,
including in your study. And so yeah. I think
that's a good
if
point.
You've got the budget resources, it would be great to include wet weather.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Delgado?
And before Bruce speaks, I want to just say what a great effort that you're doing. And I think when you can connect people to their surface water bodies and the way you're doing it, that's what's going to bring change about more than anything else. And I just love to see you bring people down to the waterfront. You know, just as an aside, I don't know if you've watched in the city of Paris, once a week during the summer, they bring sand in to create beach day or something along small portions of the Seine River. And they have umbrellas, and they're really bringing the Parisians back to connect up with, you know, their historic riverfront. I don't think anyone's swimming in it. I certainly wouldn't, but the idea is, you know, in parallel with what you're doing. I think it's great.
Thank you for the encouragement.
Yeah.
Mayor Delgado?
Yeah, it's just to start dittoing what Jeff just said. It's hard to overestimate the value of the environmental education and connection that you're doing. I really appreciate that. I lived for a couple months in Felton, spent a couple years, most of my time in the Felton area, commuting the Highway 9, San Lorenzo River, and I always felt so sorry for the river because of the logging and the railroad and the roads and the sort of ship-shod human developments along the river, just without any data assumed that the old leaky septic tanks, you know, I felt sorry for the river and all the pollution it was probably trying to handle. So this is, like, as you mentioned, completely counterintuitive for me, the results of your study so far. And what kind of discussions have there been to address the avian issue, if any? I mean, it's probably kind of, people don't think it's heresy to go after the natural source, but what discussions have there been, if any, so far?
One thing about the water quality, since you have a Felton connection, Felton's just a number of miles upstream from Santa Cruz, and the river flows through, the river does have some septic impact from septic systems, but what happens is it flows through Henry Cowell State Park before it gets to the city limits, and nature does its job, and the river is pretty clean when it comes out of Henry Cowell State Park. So you have upstream some water quality problems. Nature does its job, gets pretty clean. Water gets dirty again in the city. So it's an interesting conversation between the city saying it's the county saying, no, it's yours, and that's a fun conversation to navigate. With regard to birds, we're looking at what other communities have done. I mean, you have people with falcons out there. You have air cannons. The main thing that I learned from other places that works and that we can do make a big improvement on locally is the trash. And not giving them a food source.
So it's primarily a goal trash issue.
Well, that's the other thing, is that it's a lot. We don't have that specificity yet. Anecdotally, you look out there and there's a heck of a lot of gulls. I don't know if the bacteria load is from them, but you know, the intuitive thing would be like, yeah, there are more of them than anything else, so I think it's them. And you can do something about that. We're working on encouraging the boardwalk and the city on their partnership to manage trash on the beaches. And then the other in the end, you have to recognize that the list of controllable sources is, I mean, the actions are pretty, it's a pretty short list of actions. And then you have to say, okay, this is natural wildlife.
All right. So moving to the end of your presentation, and it segues from what you've said, that for me, the water quality improvements were cleaned up at Henry Cowell State Park. And so my vision of the future toward the end of your slides would be a river that was allowing natural functions to clean the water quality. And so I was somewhat aghast to see the pictures of these monolithic concrete cities basically eating up down to the edge of the river, and the people, you know, eating and dining and dancing and doing whatever they do on concrete, which was very different for me than the slides you showed of the fundraiser issue, where you had people next to the river, but it was still in a condition that would allow for some natural processes to help clean itself up. So are you right now just open to all visions and you're just trying to get public input, or is there a body of consensus that doing something like some of those more developed slides would be where you might go with the lower river?
We'll have to decide that as a community. I mean, just one of the examples I give to folks when I'm talking is San Antonio, and some people have a reaction like, yeah, it's really thriving, and some people say, no way, I don't want that commercial riverfront. Our leaders decades ago fought in Sacramento and in Washington, D.C. with the Army Corps so that we would have a wider channel. It could have been a narrow concrete channel, and we were successful in getting a wider one, so we have some meander even within the flood control channel. We don't know what's gonna, I mean, to really let the river do what it should do for natural function, you're talking about probably an unrealistic, we're pretty sure, an unrealistic conversation about property purchase and getting rid of the levees. So I think the short answer is we don't know yet. Right now, the levees, if you can imagine, the levees are like this with a path on top, river on this side, and then private property over here. And there are plans right now to build private property right here, and then to reach out and have a deck such that you can be on the riverwalk path, the path right next to the lower river, and in one step be on a patio and order a beer or an ice cream or a sandwich or a coffee. And that's getting a constituency. But we have to do that in a way that gets that invests in the ecosystem. So that's the balancing act that we're working towards.
Thanks again.
Yeah. If there are any other questions, may offer one, a couple other last things.
I have a couple of questions.
Okay, sure.
And first, I'll start with comment. You know, I certainly also echo the fact that connecting the people to the river, you know, is going to be key to respect its environmental conditions. So, have you done creek or river cleanup days also as a way to kind of celebrate this? Because we found that to be, you know, another very powerful way, because the people who will donate a day to pick up trash make darn sure next time they're along the river not to toss a plastic bottle on the embankment,
they love that.
For example.
Yeah, we have done.
In regard to the, birds issue, you know, Pismo Beach had a big problem also with bacteria, and there was a lot of suspicion. Where is it coming from? Is it from dogs? Is it coming from septics? Cal Poly was actually commissioned to do a study, and the outcome was pigeons. And so the use of falconry, you know, was used with limited success. The use of netting, particularly along the pier, to reduce, you know, roosting habitat. But the ultimate source was people feeding the pigeons. So by discouraging with signage and also vigilance, where you for quite a while you would have actually employees, you know, who would say, you know, if they saw people feeding the pigeons, they say, hey, you know, read the sign, you know, you can't do that. It's now quite well managed. Not saying the pigeons have disappeared, but they're not nearly in the population they were in the past. So I'm not sure if there's a lesson that can be learned in your application, but, you know, that certainly was an example that took place about 4 years ago. And
thank you.
Were you involved at all with that project? Because I saw a smiling face.
Okay.
Yeah, that was one of the projects I worked for the Environmental Biotechnology Institute, where I started my grad program. And so we're doing a
So here is a resource. Yeah, ask for a phone number and email address, and here is a connection for you, Mr. Pepping. And then my last item is a question. What about the aquatic habitat? Do you have any current studies or information? Because, you know, there's obviously a linkage between, you know, water quality and a healthy aquatic habitat. So do you have any work done by Fish and Wildlife or some other NGOs perhaps, you know, to validate where the fish habitat stands right now? You have pictures with a lot of fishing poles.
Where are
in
the fish?
One of the old ones, which the fish didn't stand a chance. I mean, these guys were side by side.
Mm-hmm. I'll try to give a short answer to that. The most recent data about fish is we have the lagoon closes seasonally every year. This year it closed very early, and we had harmful algal blooms in the lower river. Whole entirely another story. Actually, we had less of these hits on some of the data, the newest data, less of these hits, but we had other toxins in the river, so it was a little bit confusing. But the city of Santa Cruz has worked with the resource agencies to manually breach the lagoon because of flooding concerns and because of water quality. And as they do that, they're required under that permit to have a number of biologists present and what they've and they and then they seine the river after. And what they found is that when it closes like that, and the water quality is so poor, and the temperature is so high, like 27 C in a lot of cases, even as far up as where I said the salinity goes for the tidal influence, there aren't any fish in there. So the conventional wisdom, you know, if you want to be old school, is stop messing with the river, let nature do its thing. Well, there's not enough flow to punch through that lagoon and open it up. So you have a lake, and you have warm water, and you have stagnant, and you have anoxic conditions, so it's not good for fish at all. And they know that. They're gone. They're upstream. They didn't find any fish when they seined. So that's some of the recent complication. The city's top priority right now is getting a permanent solution to that lagoon flooding, and because of the requirements by the resource agencies under that effort, that's the most recent data we have, and that's October, actually, last month.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And you had a couple of
Just a couple of other things that I wanted to share as far as next steps. In addition to some of the next steps on the slide I shared, was that we will occasionally perhaps look to the regional board for funding, and you have a limit on that, but I wanted to make you aware of that, that if when that happens, you've known about this. And specifically, the EPA Urban Waters grant application is due tomorrow, actually, so we'll be applying for that. These are expensive tests, and in addition to the lab, costs. It takes a lot of staff time to do the field work as well as to lead the convenings. And so one thing I didn't think about as well, I could have worked with staff on this and I failed to, is to what would be helpful is any statement of support or validation, or even if it's only acceptance of this report. I don't know if procedurally you're allowed to do that. And then that shows to us as we look to other funders, other funding sources, that you're on board formally and officially. And it doesn't mean you have to bless perhaps all of the approach, but in as much as you can, I would share with you that's very helpful for us to continue the work and get funding to do so. So.
Very good. Well, yes, Mr. Johnson.
I don't know if it's possible, given the fact that this was agendized as an information item, but it certainly seems doable now or if necessary at the next meeting to do a resolution commending yada yada yada, if that's helpful in your funding process.
It is.
We can't do it today, but it could be agendized for a future meeting.
But it seems like a relatively minor task for staff to work up. Maybe we could try and schedule that for the next meeting.
Let the chair just write a letter saying that, you know, we've entertained and had your presentation and the board thoroughly enjoyed it, and we think you're on the right path towards getting water quality improved. Can't the chair do that?
It'd be quicker.
The chair could do that, or Ken could do
that
as well.
Okay. And I can co-sign. And I think that would go easier than going through, you know, proclamation process, and we can turn that around. What do you think, Mr. Harris?
Whatever the consensus of the board is.
Well, let's see. I see a nod.
Of course.
Yes.
Okay. We'll do it.
Four yes.
Okay.
One last question. I know we have to break because we got lunch, if I could.
Plus, we
I know testing is expensive. Have you contacted anyone at UCSC in their microbiology department, their bacteriology department? Do they have people that do any microbial DNA testing?
We haven't found them that do this. We do work with UCSC on some other analytes, but not on these. But it's a big university, and so we're not done trying to connect with those folks. So.
UC Santa Barbara has Patricia Holden, and she was involved with DNA testing of fecal coliform bacteria in the Tahiguas River. If that's the name of the river by the Tahiguas landfill, I'm not quite sure. But that river, which is like within a half mile of the landfill, had high levels of fecal coliform bacteria. There was a thought that maybe it was human generated from leachate coming out of the landfill. And the county paid for DNA testing in conjunction with Patricia Holden, and they determined it was seagulls. And the seagulls were being attracted by all the trash. Mm-hmm. You know, same story. Mm-hmm. And they hired a falconer who's there all the time and keeps the seagulls away. So that might be something for you to look, something for you to look at to further for some more insight and maybe some possibilities.
What about an autonomous falcon drone?
Actually, they're actually being used, and because I use falconry for bird abatement, starlings on my vineyard, and you do have they're not really drones; they're electric motor airplanes, and they do simulate a falcon in the silhouette. And they're very effective in replacing the, you know, the falconer, because there's also a habit forming, because the birds will recognize when the falconer arrives with his whatever pickup truck he used. They recognize the color and they leave. So I had told my falconer, I'm going to rent your pickup truck and I don't need you anymore, because they'll just take off. So it's there's an interesting dynamics there, but. Using you know, some of these new technologies, they're actually used in in blueberry fields for bird abatement, using these drones and, you know, little model airplanes, but, you know, with electric motors rather than the gasoline motor.
Well, to get the results we want, we probably should be considering some creative approaches. I'm sure that from time to time people complain about water board staff, so I wanted to share nothing but water board staff compliments today, and share with you that we have appreciation for their involvement. They're pulled in a lot of directions, and so have been involved as they're able to, and so I wanted to thank them for that through you, and thank you for the opportunity to present, and again, your flexibility in letting me come in late.
You're very welcome. It was well worth the time seeing your presentation. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Harris, when do you suggest we, how much time do we need? Because I know, Jessica, you need a little time with us.
I just need 5 minutes.
Five, so can you?
1:30.
1:30, I think, would be a good time. For that way,
yeah,
we stay on track.
Lunch is here.
Yes,
yeah.
It is.
So, yeah, 1:30, I think.
Okay, 1:30.
If you all don't dabble and you move expeditiously to the lunchroom.
We all meet in the little conference room. Right.
Yes,
okay.
But we have new carpet in there, so please be careful with your food and drinks.
We've always been careful, Mr. Harris.
Yes.